WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Right now, a wave of book bannings is sweeping schools around the country. The examples are many. But the focus is clearly on how schools teach race and racism, whether acknowledging some of the realities of history is just too divisive. The political ramifications go well beyond the classroom. In the state of Virginia, to take one recent race, Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, made the alarm over critical race theory a cornerstone of his campaign for governor, which he won, even though CRT is not part of the state curriculum. And Ted Cruz made school library books a set piece in the confirmation hearings of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson.
I find that statement a little hard to reconcile with the public record, because if you look at the Georgetown Day School's curriculum, it is filled and overflowing with critical race theory. Critical race theory, an introduction. They include the end of policing and an advocacy for abolishing police. They include how to be an anti-racist by Ibram Kendi. They include literally stacks and stacks of books. And I'll tell you two of the ones that were most stunning. They include a book called Anti-Racist Baby by Ibram Kendi. Now, this is a book that is taught at Georgetown Day School to students in pre-K through second grade, so 4 through 7 years old. Do you agree with this book that is being taught with kids that babies are racist?
Senator, I do not believe that any child should be made to feel as though they are racist or though they are not valued or though they are less than, that they are victims, that they are oppressors. I don't believe in any of that. But what I will say is that when you...
But if this culture war is today's headlines, the dynamics have been around for a long time, at least a century. That's according to my colleague Jill Lepore, who's a staff writer and a historian at Harvard. Lepore sees the school's issue in light of another epic culture war, the fight over revolution in the 1920s. Jill, sometimes it seems that the work of a historian is to point out almost that it was ever thus. You just wrote a piece of reporting for us called Why the School Wars Rage, and you link the current wave of book banning in schools across the country to something that at first glance isn't necessarily an obvious connection, the Scopes trial, the so-called trial of the century, a full 100 years ago. Jill, do you see a clear resonance between the Scopes trial and this debate over critical race theory and so much else?
I do. I think what draws together the anti-evolution campaigns of the 1920s, and we might think of them as the anti-racism campaigns of the 2020s, is a kind of battle between parents and the state. It's not like, okay, we can say here's 1922 and here's 2022, and if we just take it like an accordion and press it together, it's going to make this beautiful noise of explanation. My point is, in the 1920s, what was hot in terms of being contestable about biology is the same thing that is now contestable about history. That is to say, as a basic model for how change happens, biology and history share a really similar intellectual architecture underneath. They're both explanations for change. But in the 20s, biology really just was just sparky. Everything you talked about, but it's the age of eugenics. Everything mattered. You know, post-Reconstruction, Jim Crow, where people are in the United States are fighting over, people are dying every day due to ideas about race and the fixity of categories of race. So when arguments come along about evolution, they're immediately deeply political and easily politicized.
In 1925, biology teacher John Scopes spiraled to fame in the legal battle that became known as the monkey trial. Whether a man was descended from the monkey or just making a monkey out of man was fought in a courtroom that challenged the truth of the Darwin theory of evolution. The existence of man in the prehistoric world was denied.
And, well, you know, where humans come from, what happens after we die, like, of course that stuff's going to be sparky. So 100 years later, what are the sparks that are flying everywhere are in some ways kind of the same questions. You know, can people change? What does race mean? And then this big, big question about what's the relationship between parents' authority over their children and the state's authority over parents and children.
The press and public listened with unprecedented interest as the legal brains of both sides dug deeper and deeper into the conflicting theories of man's heritage. In this bitter legal engagement, the defense fought against the...
Well, for those of us who haven't, you know, watched Inherit the Wind lately or read a good biography of Clarence Darrow, tell us, give us the setting. What was the trial of the century and what were the sides? Who was pitted against whom?
So most people's understanding really does come from Inherit the Wind, if they haven't seen Inherit the Wind, which is the great, amazing Frederick March, Spencer Tracy, 1960 adaptation of the play. So the supposition that we get, I think, from watching that film or from, you know, most of your listeners have in mind is that there was the forces of modernism represented by Clarence Darrow, the great attorney for the damned, who strode into Dayton, Tennessee, and convinced the world. This was the first trial broadcast live on the radio. Everybody listened to it coast to coast. It's kind of incredible that that happened, but convinced everybody coast to coast that these yahoos, these hillbillies, were opposed to everything about modernity. They were opposed to science. They were opposed to Darwin, which was a basic scientific method. They were opposed to free speech. They were opposed to public discourse and public deliberation. They were superstitious, they were mystical, they were ignorant, and that this is not a trial about evolution or about John Scopes. It was a trial. Civilization itself is on trial. And opposed to Darrow and to Scopes and opposed to the ACLU and to modernism was fundamentalism. And it's really the first major battle of our culture war.
You write that the battle over public education that afflicted the 1920s has somehow started up again, this time over the teaching of American history. How are the circumstances the same or resonant at least, and how are they different, if at all?
First of all, mandatory public education was a progressive era crusade. And it was hard for a lot of people to take, hard for a lot of farming families, in particular rural families, and especially devoutly religious families. It was a progressive crusade for all the good reasons. It was good for children's health. It was good for the nation. It was good for the production of knowledge. It was good for providing, above all, for providing equality of opportunity to
young
people.
Who objected?
The people who objected at first were businesses that employed children. So, for instance, in the South, a lot of Southern textile owners did not want kids to go to school. And so some sort of big businesses used that argument to play on the fears of families, poor families with small farms, convincing them that if their kids had to go to school, they would lose their farm. When in fact, there was a whole progressive set of packages that were also designed to help those families keep their farms, right? And we also forget that at the time, compulsory vaccination was part of that same package. Even before the 1918 influenza pandemic, compulsory vaccination was accomplished by way of making schools compulsory. So you had to go to school, and in order to go to school, you had to be vaccinated. So it was kind of a whole package deal. So when people were objecting, by the 1920s, people are objecting to the teaching of evolution, they were actually objecting to a whole package of progressive reforms that included some things that we would absolutely find unsavory today. And one of them is the way that evolution was actually generally taught, which was as a kind of social Darwinism. The so-called feeble-minded and the criminal and the insane ideally should be sterilized. And we, you know, thankfully, evolution has taken improved the human race through various iterations. And it's that very that kind of contempt for ordinary people, the contempt for the poor, the contempt for rural families, the contempt for people that disagreed with all of progressivism's other reforms was a big part of progressivism, and it is still today.
Now, one of the through lines of 100 years ago and today is this idea of parental rights. You heard it in the Scope situation. You heard it really loudly in Virginia. In fact, it's considered a great screw-up that Terry McAuliffe said parents shouldn't dictate what schools teach, and Glenn Youngkin jumped all over that. What are the parental rights and how do they play into the conversation? Let's concentrate first on the anti-evolution bills of the 1920s.
Yeah, so parental rights were really invented during the progressive era as an argument to use against progressive reforms that included compulsory vaccination, compulsory education, and the abolition of child labor. So parents could say, parents who didn't want those things could say, no, these are violating our parental rights. So it was a legal gambit. And it really It just didn't work. It didn't succeed ultimately, right? We have compulsory schooling everywhere, vaccination to some degree. So the parental rights arguments didn't work, but neither did they die out. And they surface again really in the 1950s after Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, in which the U.S. Supreme Court decrees that segregation in education is unconstitutional. And the argument that is made really immediately and is made in the run-up to that decision is that telling schools that they have to be desegregated, that they have to desegregate and integrate, is a violation of parents' rights. The problem is the people who, segregationists who want to make that argument, I think, this is just my theory, they also are making what they consider to be a states' right.
Well, this is argument. It. States' rights sounds a lot like parental rights.
Right. So they decide, this is, I'm imagining some dark, smoky room where Strom Thurmond and James Eastlander, you know, smoking a cigar and saying, I know, let's call it school choice. But like, I don't know, somehow they decide to call it school choice because choice was the key word of the Cold War. Like in free societies, we have choice. And the unfree world doesn't have choice. So let's use choice. We'll call it school choice. So under the banner of school choice, they fought against school integration. And that lasted for decades.
Well, let's look at that. Today's book bannings aren't just about books. It's about critical race theory. It's about anti-racist language that became mainstream after the murder of George Floyd. It's about the 1619 Project. And arguably, it's about the way we think about the Trump era as a whole. When you listen to this debate and when you clue into it, whether it's on MSNBC or Fox News, how do you analyze it? And maybe perhaps through the prism of what you are telling us about the 20s, where are the vanities? Where are the errors? What are we not seeing about ourselves? And let the critique fall where it may on the progressive side or the conservative side.
Well, I think the conservatives are just trying to win elections on this issue. I actually doubt the sincerity of a lot of the people who are leading the charge on the conservative side. Like the idea that these various, you know, the 1619 Project or critical race theory or LGBTQ positive books are bad for our community because they divide our community. Therefore, we're going to divide our community by calling them bad. This is just bunk, right? So what's my analysis? I find that to be bunk. Now, not to say, like, I actually understand that many parents are kind of concerned about everybody's pays attention. If you're being a good parent, you're paying attention to what your kid's learning in school. Yeah, I don't fault parents who kind of get a little bit swept away in this. It's the kind of the political consultants who are devising these.
Jill, how much is this whole conversation about parental rights and how much of it is just about the midterm elections?
I think a ton of it is about the pandemic.
The pandemic? You think that's the thing?
I really do. I just think I think the anguish of parents over what the pandemic has meant for children and their own helplessness, our own helplessness in doing the parenting that is needed is a pretty considerable force at play in the world. It can be exerted in all kinds of good directions, thinking about different ways to help your community, help out your schools. But I think that great sort of pulling your children close, tucking them back into your family life inside the hard drive of your computer, watching over them in this new and different way and fearing for them, fearing even for their lives in a way you have not quite felt, and letting them back out into the world unmasked and vulnerable. I just feel like that runs through it all. And that's why we should forgive one another about people just being completely screwy in the head about what to do next. Like, I just think parents are still feeling like they're not doing enough. So I think there's that. And then there's the really, really creepy politicians who see what that is, who have the kind of political instinct, the kind of almost like animal instinct of a Donald Trump sort of person, the kind of, you know, the instinct that a Youngkin has or DeSantis has. Wow, that is this giant cloud of misery that I can just take a parachute and wrap it around that cloud of misery and just cinch it in, and I'm going to turn it into a hot air balloon and I'm going to rise politically from these people's misery. That's what I picture when I see this stuff.
You know, we've had conversations in the past and I always feel like I'm the one arguing for hysteria. This has never happened before. Something like Trump has never happened before. This has never happened before. And you're the one that edges toward, this has happened before. Don't freak out.
I think maybe the reason I write about history is that I'm the one who's always freaking out and I always need the fix that says, wait, calm down. This could be okay still. So I don't know that maybe I just am good at pretending to not be freaked out.
You're the voice of hope, Jill. Thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
You can read Jill Lepore's essay, Why the School Wars Still Rage, at newyorker.com. She's also the author of These Truths, A History of the United States, and many other books. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The news about climate seems, and we might as well say it, uniformly terrifying. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a report last month that the world is warming faster than ever. More extreme weather is exposing millions of people to acute water and food shortages. And yet for most of the world, the cost of giving up fossil fuel, converting to renewables, has been too high to pay. Bill McKibben has just written a big piece in The New Yorker with a startling conclusion, that the economics and the technology have changed radically. McKibben says that the transition to renewable energy could be far cheaper than ever predicted, and all the more so with oil prices now sky high. He joins Dorothy Wickenden on our podcast, Politics and More.
In the piece, you interview a number of experts who insist that there's cause for hope and that it's not as complicated as you'd think. Maybe tell us about Doan Farmer and what his work has uncovered.
Sure. This is a fascinating guy, now working at Oxford, running a big team. In recent years, what he's concentrated on is one of the more interesting pieces of economic data that we have. And that's figuring out which technologies fall on a steep learning curve, i.e. those that get cheaper as you do more of them. And what they've found is that the technologies that fall on this steep learning curve are solar, wind, and the batteries to store that power when the sun is down or the wind is not blowing. In fact, these are getting cheaper at about 10% a year, every year, and they've now crossed the point where they're cheaper than coal or oil or gas. That's happened in the last 3, 4, 5 years. And so it's still a relatively new fact on the ground and one that our leaders haven't fully, I think, brought on board. But it's, if you wanted an encouraging fact, that would be it. There's no longer a technological or economic obstacle to making change at the scale we need. That doesn't mean, however, that it's going to happen easily or automatically. There remains an enormous obstacle in the form of some combination of inertia and vested interest. And so far, that's been enough to block really fundamental shifts in how we do things.
Failure is just a part of life, an experience to learn from, as we're told constantly by everyone from school teachers to management consultants. We have our disappointments and embarrassments, and most of us try to learn from them and put them behind us somehow. But some of us make podcasts out of them. And failure, one particular failure, is what Connor Ratliff's Dead Eyes is all about. Staff writer Sarah Larson writes about podcasts for The New Yorker, and she spoke with Connor Ratliff last week.
Connor Ratliff is a brilliant and funny comedic performer and actor who's beloved in the improv world and among his fellow performers. Like, a lot of the funniest people we've enjoyed on TV and in movies in the last few years think Connor's one of the funniest people they know. So if he's so great and beloved, why doesn't everybody know who he is?
There was one point I was approached by an agent or a manager, I don't even remember which they were. He said, "What's your story? Why? How come you don't have representation?" And I said, "Well, because I have no interest in working in show business. I don't like it."
What could make someone who loves performing and who's so good at it stop performing? It all begins with Tom Hanks.
I'm a huge Tom Hanks fan and always have been. I was the kid in high school that when people would talk about you know, this Tom Hanks movie or that Tom Hanks movie, I'd be like, but do you remember his episodes on Family Ties? Like, those were really good.
So you can imagine how excited Connor was when, not long after he got out of acting school, he was cast in a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, created by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks.
And then the news got even better because I found out that Tom Hanks is going to be directing episode 5, which is the episode that I was supposed to be in. So it just kept getting better and better. I was thinking, this is such a great start. Things are going to start working out for me now because I'm in this Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks, HBO prestige production. And then the day before I was supposed to film my scene, I had already had my haircut, my costume fitting. Everything was ready to go. I get a frantic call from someone in my agent's office, and they deliver me this message. Tom Hanks has looked at your audition tape, and he's having second thoughts. He thinks you have dead eyes. And so I got on a train, and the whole time thinking, what do I do? How do I'm going to have to re-audition in person for Tom Hanks. And knowing that he thinks I have dead eyes. And there's very little I can do about it. I get to Hatfield Air Base, I wait, I hear Tom Hanks arrive, and I read the scene for him, and then it was over. And he was very nice, but then a few minutes later, they said, we've decided to go another way.
It's one thing to get fired. Lots of people get fired. We've all had our disappointments. It's another thing to get fired by the Oscar-winning American treasure, Tom Hanks. And to hear that he thinks you have dead eyes, what does that even mean? It sounds terrible. It's like hearing you have a dead soul. Connor did not take it well. I wouldn't have either. He started to doubt whether he had what it took to make it as an actor.
And you're sort of like, this is not what I want my life to be.
So Connor's doing great now, but his path to where he is was circuitous. It involved quitting acting, 10 years working at Barnes & Noble in Union Square, doing improv at UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, and playing a dollar bill in a White Castle commercial.
Today I stand in this $3 bill for value, for variety, for freedom. Introducing White Castle's $3 freedom to choose, 5 sliders to choose.
Throughout it all, he was still haunted by the fact that Tom Hanks had fired him for having dead eyes. So he did what any comedian would do. He started a podcast.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
So what was the pitch that you were giving to podcast companies at the time?
I mean, the pitch was like, we'll treat it like a true crime podcast. We'll act like, we'll just take it really seriously. And comedically, it will be the most narcissistic podcast in the world. You know, an actor trying to find out, like, why did this thing happen to me? But we'll use that as a way of, like, pivoting to other people's stories. So we use sort of, like, comedic narcissism, but then genuine, like, empathy. And I could also talk to anybody famous that I knew who might be interesting, because I knew I would get to their stories of failure and disappointment.
You're kind of like, am I doing anything right? I'm 48 years old. Like, I've been doing this more than I haven't in my life at this point. But when you're younger and something like this happens, I had it happen to me 15 times with pilots, to the point where Les Moonves at CBS had told my agents to stop sending me in because, and I quote, "John Hamm will never be a television star."
Wow. What did you feel like when you heard that?
Not great. And then you start to, what did I do in the room?
Like, I mean, one of the great strengths of the show, I think, is obviously the breadth and depth of people you talk to and hearing the stories of all these little moments of triumph and failure in various people's careers and things they tried to do that didn't work out or a dream they had that didn't come to pass. And it humanizes everyone. And it reminds you that there are all these stories behind, you know, the TV and movies that you love that are just stories of creative misfires and, you know, all the things that we all go through that we just don't hear about. How did you know about your potential guests' professional disappointments that they may have had? Did you just assume everyone had them?
I assume that everyone had them. We've all heard people complaining about how things didn't go their way. And I think the fact that my approach to it is not that I'm saying it's no big deal, but I am saying, like, it's funny and we should put it in perspective.
Yeah.
It's a universal enough thing. The number of emails that I've gotten from people who have no connection to show business, who are like, this is just like what it's like to work in, you know, my office. Like, I'm not being listened to, or they're making a decision that makes no sense, you know?
Yeah.
Or this thing happened and it's bad for me, but it's good for the store or something, you know?
Well, everybody has vulnerability and everybody has professional, you know, things that you hope for, try for, are disappointed by, aren't good at, you know, all that stuff. And I think that for non-actors like me and many other listeners, the idea of your body coming into it in such a direct way, what you happen to look like, you know, what you do with what you happen to look like, that being part of whether you get work or not and the kind of work you get is just horrifying.
Yeah.
So it's heightened, I think, for a lot of listeners. And maybe we feel some relief and satisfaction that we are not on TV or trying to be an actor. You know, there's something that...
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I just remembered this moment from the Freaks and Geeks Guys episode where Judd Apatow is telling that story about auditioning for Jim Henson.
I auditioned and I got a call where they said, Jim Henson doesn't want you, but he would like to buy your ideas. Jim Henson said that he thought you lacked warmth. And it knocked me out to this day.
The most devastating thing you can imagine. And also, he doesn't lack warmth. I mean, we all know this. Anyone who's ever seen Judd Apatow knows that that's what's great about his work is his warmth and his generosity.
Yeah.
But to hear that as a young, struggling...
If Jim Henson had lived to the year 2015, he would have had an experience with Judd Apatow. They probably would have worked together. Judd Apatow probably would have produced a Muppet movie, you know? Like, they would have been able to hash it out. But because it happened and then Jim Henson is tragically taken from us, he never gets anything close to closure. He just has to live with that note, you know?
So I assume that kind of closure was what you were hoping to get from Tom Hanks.
I mean, there were a lot of things. I think, of course, the premise sounds like the most entitled thing in the world. It's just like, this, I was wronged and I must have a personal public sit down, which I think anyone who's listened to even one episode of it knows that, like, I never felt like, well, I deserve and am and therefore entitled to a sit down with Tom Hanks.
Right. Yeah.
One of the goals of the podcast, it wasn't just I wanted to harangue him into being on it. I wanted to make a podcast that was good enough that it would make sense.
Right.
That he might want to come on it.
Yeah.
And that he might have a good time being on it.
So from the very first episode of Dead Eyes, Connor's been hoping to get Tom Hanks on the show.
We got to get Hanks on this. I cannot wait. I cannot wait for you guys to bury the hatchet and become old friends.
What I would like to do ideally is to get a chance to re-audition for him, or even just have him look at my reel. Maybe that'd be that would be less nerve-wracking for me if I could just show him my reel and be like, "Look, this is."
Do you think these are Dead Eyes, buddy?
A handful of shows, you know.
Getting Tom Hanks's attention is not as easy as you might imagine.
I sent a typewritten letter to his production offices.
Because he's a huge fan of old typewriters, and he has a huge collection, yeah.
He loves typewriters. I don't know this for certain, but I'm pretty sure Colin vouched for it as, like, this is a good podcast.
Yeah. So you have friends in common with Colin Hanks. And
he's done a lot of, you know, comedy podcasts with people that I'm friends with. And so
it seemed like the path was two of his of Tom Hanks's kids, Colin and
Elizabeth. Yeah.
Learned of your podcast, listened to it on their own and liked it.
Yeah.
And told him about it. And he was initially skeptical. They're like, no, it's good. And then.
Yeah. So I got this email.
This is what the email said. Connor, not sure how to volunteer my services to you, but joining you on your podcast would be a pleasure. Tom. And then below that it says, T. Hanks. So, and I'm like, is this the email? Or is this someone pranking me? Like, it was really hard to know. So we verified it. And so then I emailed Tom back the next morning. And then we're just emailing back and forth, figuring out, like, when do we want to... I was like, would you be comfortable meeting in person?
So you should listen to the whole episode. It's beautiful. And I won't spoil it for you. But suffice to say, the Deadeyes incident was not as memorable to Tom as it was to Connor.
Does any of this ring a bell with you?
Not a single moment of this rings a bell.
Two moments in that episode that really stick out. One is when I talk about him being a two-time Academy Award winner, and he says, well, those days were long over by the time...
That was crazy, yeah. But he's talking about the 80s.
But just the idea that by that point, he was no longer... Yeah, he was no longer winning Oscars every year.
Right.
And that it was a slight source of even whimsical insecurity was very interesting. So I'm like, oh, everybody has that feeling of like, well, have I peaked, or is there something different, or are people not, you know?
Yeah.
The other moment that I didn't even notice until we were listening to the tapes and editing through them, and it was pointed out, the moment where I talk about how excited I was that I was going to be directed by one of my favorite actors, and then Tom Hanks' response is, he goes, "Bang." He makes the noise, the boing noise. He goes, boing. I asked them, I said, can you isolate that sound and send it to me? Hold on. I have it here. Hold on. I'm going to play it. This is like, if I take nothing else from this experience, I take this noise.
Boing.
It is, that is so funny to me.
Boing.
I'll spend the rest of my life unpacking that boing.
Season 4, the boing. What did it mean? So this leads me to another question, the obvious question, which is this the end? You know, are you thinking about a fourth season or?
Well, for people who are thinking this is the perfect ending, it is an ending. And for anyone who wants it to be like the forever end and I disappear forever, you can just not pay attention if I ever do anything else. Like, it's certainly the end of it as an investigative pot. Like, my Band of Brothers story doesn't have any, like, I don't have any other investigating to do. But I think there will be other versions of this that will have more freedom to... do the thing that always felt a little bit like we were cheating or being tricky, when we'd be like, this episode's going to be about this other thing. Because a lot of people are like, I'm so sad that it's over. And we haven't announced that it's over. Yeah. Like, it's like the number of people who have announced that the podcast is over without me saying that it's over has been very funny to me.
Everyone's firing you now.
Connor Ratliff's podcast Deadeyes just wrapped up its third season, and you can read more from Sarah Larson at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Helen Rosner is a food expert for the New Yorker, and one of her favorite things to do is to get together with another pro, a writer or a chef, and find something new to cook.
Okay, I'm going to get the fennel and the citrus.
And during the pandemic, before it was really safe to go into other people's homes or kitchens, Helen got pretty creative.
I'm Helen Rosner. I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker, and I am standing in my Brooklyn kitchen right now in front of a cutting board with a pile of fennel, parsley, vinegar, a couple of bags of plantain chips. There's a lot of really cool, interesting stuff here in front of me, and the most important thing in front of me is my phone, which is currently in the middle of a FaceTime call with the chef Bryant Terry.
Hey, Helen.
Hey, how's it going? The author of the cookbook Vegetable Kingdom, which is one of my favorite books of the year.
Helen Rosner talked with Bryant Terry in 2020.
And we're going to make a recipe for, in the book, it's citrus and garlic herb braised fennel. And Bryant is in his kitchen in Oakland, California. Hey, Bryant.
Hey, Helen. I'm here in my backyard in Oakland, ready to cook.
Tell me what goes into this recipe. It looks like there's a couple of different parts here.
Yeah. So the cornerstone of the recipe is actually the mojo, which is a kind of citrus and garlic condiment or marinade that's used in Cuban cooking, oftentimes to marinate meat. And I thought that it would be fun to take fennel bulbs and give them a nice sear to give them some color and a little crisp on the outside, and then baste them in this mojo in a similar way that one might baste a turkey.
Cool. So we should do that part first, right? We should make the sauce.
So yeah, the sauce should be made first because you want to let it rest for an hour so that the flavors can concentrate and marry, and that's going to set you up.
And I bet that really makes the garlic just get super garlicky too, right?
Yeah.
Just like a garlic explosion.
You had a garlic explosion.
I'm going to just start measuring out the orange juice and the lime juice and stuff while you talk to me about the recipe, okay?
Okay, cool.
So you've been doing this stuff for a long time. Have you always known that you were going to be a cookbook author? How did you come to this?
You know, I didn't. I thought I was going to be a professor. And when I was a grad student at NYU, I started doing more research on the Black Panther Party and their survival programs. And I think they were so cutting edge in their analysis and understanding this intersection of poverty, malnutrition, and institutional racism back in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. So their grocery giveaways and their free breakfast for children program really excited me to do my part in creating a more healthy and sustainable food system. Do you mind if I give you some cooking tips?
Yeah,
as
no,
you're
tell me what to
cooking?
Do.
Okay. When you're working with citrus, a lot of people don't realize that you can actually get a lot more juice from your orange, lime, lemon if you actually take the fruit and then roll it with the palm of your hand back and forth for about 15 to 20 seconds, because that starts to break down the constitution of it. And so you'll get more, it'll yield more juice.
And a thing that I learned the hard way early in my cooking life is that if you're going to zest something and juice something, you always need to zest it first.
Yes, that's a great point. You definitely want to zest it first.
You know, Bryant, while you were talking just now, I was using your rolling out the citrus technique on some of the limes that I was about to juice. Hold on, I'm going to try this again. It was amazing. It was like Niagara Falls coming out of this lime. Yes, that's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. You've changed the game for me. This is amazing.
It works well.
All right, let's do the fennel. So we talked a little bit about fennel, but I was so struck by one of the phrases that you use to describe your approach to fennel. You talk about blackifying it and that you want to bring to food, like, this sense of your Blackness and the Blackness of the context of your culture, and use this, like, very beautiful phrase, your blood and spiritual ancestors, which I think is such a moving way of of talking about, like, the communities that we arise from. Has it always been kind of a conscious choice for you to Blackify food?
I feel like more than Blackifying it, my approach has been about uplifting Black food. And, you know, that started when I was in culinary school, and I was just really, I won't say put off, but it was disappointing that there was such an emphasis on classical French and classical Italian techniques. And one of the things I feel like I've been fighting since I started this work is pushing back against the kind of reductive ways in which people imagine, think about, talk about Black food. And I think so often when people think about Black food, what they're thinking about are two different things. And sometimes they're kind of playing with each other. But one is antebellum survival food. I can't tell you how many times I've heard people kind of like vilify African-American cuisine and kind of reducing it to what they call slave food. You know, whatever the plantation owners didn't want, the scraps, the remnants of, you know, the vegetables or the animal viscera, whatever it is, like, that's the stuff that was discarded and we just had to, like, eat it and make do. Why would we want to eat that? So there's that line of thinking. And then the other one is people reduce African-American cuisine to soul food, which in my mind are, you know, kind of big flavored meats and, you know, fatty desserts and overcooked vegetables that you might find at, you know, soul food restaurants. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like the kind of core, the traditional staples of African-American cuisine, we're talking about things like black-eyed peas, sugar snap peas, pole beans, lima beans, you know, dark leafy greens like collards, mustards, turnips, kale, dandelions. And so one of my major projects has been kind of helping people reimagine Black food in all its diversity and complexity.
And how does this connect to the fact that your recipes are vegan and that the cooking that you're doing is plant-based? Does that come from a similar politics?
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of the way that most people imagine veganism, they're either thinking about like upper middle class white suburbanites or kind of like young white hipsters who are living in, you know, urban centers, right?
Like veganism is like an aesthetic rather than a politic.
It's an aesthetic. It's something that white people own. And I think it's important that people understand that there's a history of Black food and health-led activism throughout the 20th century. And my first contact with the idea of vegetarianism came from Black Seventh-day Adventists. And then after I read Malcolm X and was obsessed with the Nation of Islam, I learned about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and his health ministry. He wrote two books, How to Eat to Live, which was his way of helping Black folks think about eating more healthfully. You know, I think about Dick Gregory, the comedian and social justice activist, and his emphasis on food. I mean, the thing that politicized me was a hip-hop song about factory farming called Beef by the rapper KRS-One from the group Boogie Down Production.
Beef, what a relief. When will this poisonous product cease? This is another public service announcement. You can believe it or you can doubt it. Let us begin now with the cow, the way it gets to your plate and how.
And so, you know, Black people are suffering from the highest rates of preventable diet-related illnesses, heart disease, hypertension, type 2 diabetes. I would argue that we needn't look any further than our own cultural cuisine in order to find better health.
I love that.
So you have all your vinegars, your citrus in there?
Yep, all my citrus is in there. I think it's garlic time. Could I use like a microplane or grate it or something like that?
You know, you could. I've never...
You're allowed to say no, you know. I feel like that was a tone of voice that implied to me that you think it's a bad idea. And you
no, I just hadn't thought about it, but...
And we're going to let that intensify while everything else happens. I love fennel. I'm like super obsessed with fennel. And I don't really love black licorice. I just want to take a bite out of it.
You know what?
So good.
Let me do that too. I don't even know if I've ever even attempted to take like a full on. This is kind of like
I would eat it like an apple
bite.
Oh.
I'm going to do this in Berkeley, and they're going to think I'm a god. I'm going to start me a cult the cult of eating fennel rock.
So in Vegetable Kingdom, you assign a track to each recipe. Each recipe has a song, and you've got this gorgeous playlist at the beginning of the book that puts them all mm-hmm. together. And the song that goes with this recipe is Afro Q, parentheses, Bembe, by Mongo Santa Maria from the album What Do You Mean? So what is it about this song that you particularly like?
Just the African rhythms. If I close my eyes, I just feel like I'm being transported back to New Orleans, to Havana, to Lagos. It's all about the African rhythms.
What kind of pan should I use for this?
You're good to go. That cast iron skillet is exactly where you want to be.
So I'm going to... Oh, yeah. You hear that sizzle? Okay, so I've warmed the sauce in the skillet. I have nestled beautifully in my golden pieces of fennel. And now we're going to let them braise. This is where the magic happens, right? All right. Let's take a bite. Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm obviously over here thinking that this is the bomb. What do you think?
This is the bomb. This is totally the bomb. That is the technical term, I think, for this dish.
Brian Terry's most recent book is Black Food, and he spoke with The New Yorker's Helen Rosner. Now, full disclosure, we skipped a few steps as they were making that dish, and I guess you may have suspected as much. And if you want to try the braised fennel in Citrus Mojo, you can find every single one of the steps at newyorkerradio.org. Helen Rosner will be back on the show in a couple of weeks after spending some time in the kitchen with Andy Baragani of Bon Appetit. I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Meng-Fei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine.
Original music in this week's show was composed by Alex Barron.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.